20th of May, 1979. Well, the first thing I'd like to talk about you and ask you about is how you, a very interesting sort of personal background of union activists. I'm just wondering how you came to be a nurse in the first place.
Well,
what you did before.
Before I started nursing, I worked in the mines. I spent a total of about 23 years working in the mines. Then I met the lady who was to become my wife. Yes. I met the lady who was to become my wife, who was then working as a ward sister at Chernwell Hospital, that is, this hospital. Hi, welcome.
You were saying how...
Yes, I was saying how I met my wife, who was working here as a sister. Had been for quite a number of years then as a ward sister. We got married, then after much prodding and persuading from Cecilia, who's her name, I call her Sis, she persuaded me to come as a nurse at Cherry Knoll. Like a lot of people, of course, one often finds things that one would make a nurse, whether it's one transforms easily from being a miner to being a nurse is another matter. I think I made the transition fairly well. So anyway, after a year after being married, I came to Chernwell Hospital, interviewed by the chief male nurse, who of course asked the usual questions, why do you want to become a nurse? And of course, one plus one way through that. Medical examination.
What kind of reasons did you give?
Well, much of what I've been seeing in order is the kind of thing that one often feels one should be doing. Whether it's in one's nature that way, I don't know, but you often hear of even people who are mentally ill who want to become brain surgeons. You know, it seems to be the kind of life that attracts people.
Oh,
it doesn't always attract the proper kind of people. It often attracts a peculiar element, which is, better not go into that too far. But anyway, as I say, then I was interviewed by the psychologist at that time, Mr. Majorwick. And if I can say it without appearing too boastful, when this gentleman was leaving a year or 2 years ago, he came to see me to say goodbye and then divulged the information that I had been one of the top three that he interviewed in his career, which was quite flattering, you may say. I ought to have gone to university, he said, but that doesn't matter, I'm still happy. As a matter of fact, I had been to university, if you only but knew it. I went to the what was called then, in those days, the Catholic Workers' College in Oxford. Nowadays called Plato Hall. Mm-hmm. It's moved from Oxford out into Headington, which of course is in the Oxford city boundaries, but never mind. And I spent 2 years there doing economics, politics, philosophy,
this was
political
after
history.
You started nursing or before?
Oh, this was when I was still in the mines.
Oh, when you were
yes.
still in the
mines? I spent 2 years, two university years at the Catholic Workers' College. Doing their 2 years of their PPI course. That's politics, philosophy, economics. So of course Shirley Williams does that kind of thing. As a matter of fact, Shirley Williams, if I can say it, was a contemporary of mine at Oxford.
Was she?
Shirley Williams, yes. She was then known as the Red Queen of Somerville.
Yes. Were you active in the union as a miner?
As a miner, yes. Actually, I was also on the local parish council then. I ought to have been a district councillor. Do you want the story of how I was not a district councillor?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, in those days, and it happens a great deal now, that all you need in this particular kind of area where I live, which is Hordon Colliery, the Labour Party held full swing. Therefore, all you had to do to become local councillor, district councillor, county councillor, really, was to obtain the nomination of the Miners' Lodge. See, they're the people who played the piper and they're more or less called the tune, besides which most people voted Labour. Well, I was first nominated for the local parish council. That is, that the Miners' Lodge nominates a number and they go for election. Well, obviously, in an area like that, they are elected. Later, I intended going further as a district councillor. And this particular Sunday morning, where the nominations were coming up, a special meeting in the Miners' Lodge, Miners' Hall, I should say, for the nominations, I understand there were currently 6 seats on the District Council from Horden. These are the 6 seats nominated by the Horden Miners' Lodge. Mm. Well, when the chairman of the Lodge asked for nominations for the District Council, one of the sitting members of the District Council, a very good friend of mine, and this will give you some indication of what politics is all about, a very good friend of mine, a contemporary of my father's, went to school together and all that kind of thing, stood up and started to glorify the achievements of the District Councillors over the last session of the Council, and more or less moving himself that all 6 councillors should be re-elected. Which duly happened.
So you never.
So that's how I was railroaded off, you know, see. Yeah. With a bit more experience, that could have been overcome, but as a fairly young man then, I didn't have what it took to really meet a situation like that.
So as a young man, you were involved in the Labour Party and.
The Labour Party and the trade unions, yes. Through the union, I attended many. Summer schools, weekend courses, and that kind of thing. You know. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting. My very first time I went away on a miners' scholarship for 1 week, a friend of mine, Martin Brennan, I was very friendly with his son at that time. His son was killed during the war. He was a rear gunner. He went to school with me. And Martin Brennan came to me one day, the father. He said, "Have you seen the notice in the miners' hall window?" I said, "No, I haven't, but I will do." I went to have a look at it, and it said scholarships were available for 1 week at Cloughton Hall in Derby, in the Peak District. Application had been made, and then they sent me a list of subjects to take as an essay. So I wrote the essay and was duly accepted. The problem then, I hope this is a story that will be interested in, the problem then was knowing what to do to have the week off to go to the summer school. So I went down to try and see the colliery manager to ask him for the week off. I bumped into the colliery manager's secretary, who happened to be a chap who I stood for as best man at his wedding. And he said, "I'm sorry, James, no chance have you seen Mr. MacKillop." The chap, the colliery manager's name, Mr. MacKillop, who died 3-4 years ago. And I was going to walk away then, but he says, "Wait a minute now." He says, "I'll see what I can do." He went away and he came back. He said, "Well, Mr. MacKillop has got a couple of minutes for you." So I went up into the committee room, and Mr. MacKillop was chairing a meeting of all the local top brass, the area officers, what have you. And he asked me with a very stern expression, just what was I after? So I told him, "Well, I've got this scholarship down to Walker, to Derbyshire, the Peak District, through the miners." Oh, he started to get a bit interested then. He asked me how I came to go there. I understand I was just a young lad facing all these people in this committee room,
yeah.
Who in those days used to be. So Mr. MacKillop, asked me how I got there, and I told him I wrote an essay. So he swiveled around his chair and asked me, "Well, what do you write about?" And of course, all this time this meeting was held up. To cut a long story short, he ended up by saying, "Well, of course take a week. Is that enough? I sure you don't want a month."
Mm. Yeah. Was it your interest in learning? Was your interest in learning and education one of the reasons why you wanted to become a nurse, do you think? Or was it more to do with the human side?
I don't think so, no. I think, frankly, it was more by pressure from my wife, who didn't like the idea of me working in the pit.
Oh,
especially when I told her some of the hair-raising things you can do in the pit.
The danger?
You know, danger to the outsider, calculated risks to the internee, you might say. For instance, it's not everybody's cup of tea to stand on top of a pit cage and go down 1,200 feet, which is something I did fairly often.
And your wife got worried about when you went off in the
naturally
morning.
Concerned. And of course, here again, I don't want to flatter myself, but according to her, I was wasted doing a job like that. Well, depends. Core's important too.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that, so that in many ways, people, were other miners attracted in for the similar reasons, do you think, or?
There's not a great number of miners come these days. I think in the past, you see, the thing was, at the time I started here, and for years before that, the people who started nursing in this particular kind of work, that's psychiatric nursing, or mental nursing as we used to call it then, were people of a mature outlook and in age also. Mm. They usually got another job before they came here, so they were used to life. Mm. And of course, very often in those days as well, it was an advantage to be a good footballer or be able to play the fiddle or a trumpet or what have you. Have well, some other kind of talent. I had none, so I must have got through one. Yes. Yeah. Of course, since then, the age eventually, or the age of people coming in, I should say, has went down and down, and very often now you find them coming in at 18, 19 and 20 year old. Personally, not a good thing from my point of view, insofar as I don't believe they have the experience of life to do the guidance and what have you on this particular kind of job. So I think we're lacking in that respect. Of course, there again, one doesn't expect that these days, could you possibly attract people into this job if you wait till you were 26, 30, or what have you?
This would be in the 1950s that you came in, was it? Or?
No. When I came here, would be, I believe, November 61, when I started, yes.
That was just after the 1959 Mental Health Act?
That's correct, yes.
Which you brought in,
yes. Okay. So I came at the period of quite rapid change, you may say. Mm. I caught what you may call it the tail end of one era and the beginning of another. Mm. In other words, I came in when there was more money being allotted to mental hospitals. When I came, you still had the brown paint of the institutions, you know, the uncarpeted floors, the bareness of the whole atmosphere of a mental hospital was bare. You know, patients were bare, old clothing, treatment not what it might be. Yeah. No doubt, of course, the outlook then in those days was different to what it is now. I hope we're a bit more enlightened. Because when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about the way that people may have treated the inmates at that time. And not always through any kind of maliciousness, often through ignorance on the atmosphere of the of those days.
In practical terms, how would that?
The treatment could be a bit harsh. Mm. No doubt, they suffered from tremendous overcrowding. Many doors were locked. Mm. So there's a tremendous feeling of frustration among both staff and of patients, which could result in a flare-up. There were certain wards where even to be in the ward was a matter of stress, that you were looking over your shoulder constantly. Mm. These particular wards, you couldn't allow anyone to be behind you, because it could happen. Of course, after I'd been here just a few years, the doors were opened, and this was a tremendous step. I think the biggest breakthrough that psychiatry's ever had, even opposed to what was often thought to be the big breakthrough, was the tranquilizing drugs, such as Largactyl and Merrill, as you remember.
Yeah. But you think that it was the act of opening the doors?
The act of opening the doors. I've spoke to people who'd constantly been locked up, people who'd been checked in and out the wards when they did go out. Supposedly one was going out with a working party, as we used to do in those days, going out in the fields to bale here, cut turnips, this kind of thing. You had to know how many patients you took out. You had to return the same number. Mm. After meals, you would count the cutlery, how many knives had been issued, how many knives came back. And if one was missing, then of course there was a right to hue and cry. It was a grievous sin to lose a knife in those days. Of course, naturally, people were afraid that if a knife was lost, somebody's got it and someone may use it.
Yeah.
How far that would have happened in practice, one is a bit not too sure. But as I say, I talked to these people afterwards when the doors had been opened, and they said it was marvellous. The whole weight had been lifted from them. They didn't feel as though they were in prison. They were free, they felt free and easy. I've seen people going down the drive shortly after that, and my first impulse was to stop, grab them and put them in the car.
What, the patient?
The patient.
Because you're so used
because
to
it. Because so used, patients, you never dream of walking down the drive on their own. But there they were, going down the drive, waiting for the pictures and what have you.
In a way, it must have been hard in a way for staff to get used to those changing conditions, was it?
I think the transition came, I suppose there could be one or two whose outlook had been more or less atrophied, but by and large I think the transition was made fairly comfortably, and to the benefit of everyone, patients and staff, and the whole management of the hospital. And of course in those days, as I say, more money was coming in, the whole environment for the patient and for the staff of course was greatly enhanced. Nice coloured paints and patterned wallpapers, large numbers of beds taken down. In other words, the population was reduced. I remember about 1,140 patients, now down to about 740. So it has made things much better for both sides, staff and patients. With the result that now nursing staffs can't spend more time individually with patients. Instead of having a ward with, say, 40 patients on with three staff, you might now have a ward of 25 patients with three staff. So things are much better all around.
At that time, also, the hospital was divided very much between the male and female side, wasn't it?
It was strictly male and female. You had male wards and you had female wards, and never the twain should meet. They had their own boss system, if you may say, their own management system of the chief male nurse and his deputies, the matron and her deputies. Then, of course, with the 1974 reorganisation, and the Salmon Report, which came out much the same time, the whole management structure was turned inside out. Possibly was, well, obviously with some good results, at the same time with some may say disastrous results in many areas. Integration has been a thorny problem that the hospital, or indeed the country as a whole, has never really grasped. It works in some circumstances, strictly controlled, but I think these hospitals would be very few and far between. Certainly in my experience in talking to people from other hospitals, they are not happy with the situation. I do know a few years ago I sat on a working party for the regional health authority to look into the whole question of integration. We examined the fors and against, the advantages and disadvantages.
Well, this is integration on both male patients and female
patients,
sides.
Yes. We came forward with certain recommendations. None of those recommendations have been carried out. As a matter of fact, this was mentioned at our last regional council meeting in Newcastle last week. And the people there agreed that these recommendations just had not been carried out.
Was there a lot of competition between the chief male nurse and the matron? How did they get on?
No, I think it was a case of you run your side the way you want to, and I run my side the way I want to. And so there was certainly no friction, none whatsoever. And of course, socially, you met. It was really only in the ward environment that you had the male and female. Working parties would often meet together outside.
Would they?
Social, yes. Well, females also used to go outside working.
To do what kind of jobs?
Even in the fields.
So they'd have joined male and female?
Yes. They work in the fields when I started. They go to various workshops in the hospital, so sort of working with the tailor, the gardeners, the farm. I don't recall women on the farm, but certainly the male patients worked on the farms. But socially, of course, they mixed. When you met in the hall for bingo, dancing, and that kind of thing, then everybody just joined in.
What was the size of the nursing staff around that time, was it?
The total nursing staff would be around 180 to 200. Mm. It now stands around 380.
And what kind, I mean, was there much ancillary support at that time?
At that time, we had no such things as porters.
No porters at all?
No porters at all. Not one.
So?
We had a handful of ward maids.
Mm.
A handful. All the work on the wards was done primarily by the patients and by the nursing staff.
But the nurses used to supervise
the patients, yes.
The patient carrier and things like that?
Yes,
or?
Yes. Yeah. For instance, in those days, all the wards had coal fires.
Mm.
There used to be a very large coal bunker here. And the first job of, say, two particular patients on a ward, their first job in the morning, after breakfast, would be to get their pails down to the coal bunker and come back with the stock of coal for that particular ward for that day.
Mm.
Of course, since then, the coal has been done away with. I think all the fireplaces have been taken out, and now it's all a matter of the central heating system, you may say.
Mm. So, in fact, what's happened is the ancillary staff has grown as the patients have done less of the work. Is that what?
This is it. Of course, here again, the patients are getting older.
Mm. Well, the average age of patients.
The average age of patients is rising.
Mm.
The vast majority of the patients in the hospital now are over 65.
Mm.
I couldn't give the exact details at the moment, but certainly the majority are over 65 year old, which obviously they couldn't be expected to do the jobs they used to do in the past.
Mm.
So the first thing the management did was to increase the number of domestics.
Mm.
So at the moment now we have about 80 domestics working.
Mm.
A few years ago the then divisional nursing officer had one porter, then later on he increased it to two. And he always used to make it both, so I've now increased the portering establishment by 100%. Gone up from one to two. Then a few years ago, two or three years ago, we had a cadet scheme here, had been operating for quite a number of years. That is, people who used to come in pre-nursing period. They couldn't begin nursing until they were 18, but they would start here at 16, doing jobs in various departments just to get the feel of the hospital, knowing the patients, knowing the staff over here, generally getting the feel of the run of the place. And then when they were 18, or of course also going on a day release course to Sunderland. Then when they were 18, they would go to the school here. And we often found that this was a valuable, very valuable source of recruitment. Because not only did you have these people who were already here, but also have people who knew the hospital, and they became some of our very best nurses. Then, one may say, in a sense, unfortunately, they had a couple of quite dramatic wage increases. And I believe that the Area Health Authority were a bit concerned at how much it was costing to run the cadet scheme, irrespective of what a good scheme it was for recruitment. So the scheme was phased out and they employed porters, which was against my better judgment, because I thought the cadet scheme was the more valuable of the two. And I didn't see why cadets should be phased out to employ porters. I'm not saying the porters shouldn't be employed. I don't want to give the wrong impression there.
Yeah.
So now the portering staff must be around about, well, it's difficult to say, because over the last year or so there's been a bigger tie-up with the hospital and the area insofar as supplies are concerned. So we've become a sort of central supply system for the area, so we have all kinds of porters now that I'm just not aware of.
So there's a supplies department?
Yes, but the portering staff are such, that is the people who fetch and carry, must only number about eight.
Presumably there was a union at the union, well, from the records it's clear that the union was organised at that time. Was it very active when you came here? I mean, what kinds of...
I think it's always been, well, it's been a union like any other union. you get a local issue, then there's tremendous interest. Mm. When I was at the Horden Colliery, with a total membership of over 3,000, mm. more often than not, when one went there on Thursday night to a lodge meeting, the chairman would be hard pushed to find a quorum. Mm. And very often, there's been business done at Horden Colliery involving thousands upon thousands of pounds which have been passed without a quorum. Mm. But if you had a local issue, something developed which affected the men very deeply, then you would find that miners' hall absolutely packed. Mm. So the same thing happened here, and still happens here. You can call a branch meeting and have four or five people turn up. Mm. In other words, you don't even have a quorum. Mm. But of course the business goes ahead, because a quorum, to those who know the game, is something you use only when there's any particular nasty business comes up that you'd rather not have. And then the chairman says, can we have a count? But he doesn't, if he has any sense, he doesn't come before the meeting, because very often you won't have any meeting at all at chair.
Who was the branch secretary at the time? Can you remember when you started as the branch secretary?
The branch secretary was Alec McGeever, who then was a charge nurse filling the post of unqualified tutor. Mm. The branch chairman was Mr. Alan Hughes, who is now the divisional nursing officer.
And it was mainly, well, as you said, there were very few ancillary workers anyway, is that right?
There were very few ancillary workers then. A handful of ward maids, three or four men who worked in the boiler house, one or two store men. That kind of thing.
But were they
all those departments were very sparse demand.
But were they in the union as well?
Oh yes, the union of course takes all grades of staff.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, what kind of member was the membership very large at that time? Was it? I mean, what
the membership at that time? Well, apart from a few who were in Nalgo, all staff were not in the union, but those who were in the union were members of the Confederation.
There wasn't. What about the Royal College? Was that organised here?
The Royal College had a number of members, but they were very quiet. They didn't do anything or function as a union, really, which is perhaps a good thing, because I never maintain that they are a union.
How about the same proportions of men and women staff in the union, or did the men tend to join the union more than
the men tend to join the union more than the women, of course. Mm. Some of the women could be very difficult to persuade into the union. The same applies now in many cases. Yeah. Even though you'll find the majority of people are, the members are male.
Mm. So there's more men in the union?
More men, yes. Yes.
What kinds of issues did the union, I mean, can you remember some of the issues that cropped up in those early days?
Push off.
If I said that most people joined the union for protection and for because of the Whitley Council at national level, but nothing really, not very much cropped up locally in those days, that'd be sort of more or less...
Yes, the early days were more or less taken up with... not exactly petty, trivial things, but obviously things to do with conditions of work, the times of starting, resolutions going to the regional council regarding holidays, that kind of thing. All just local issues that affected just the local people. Nothing of earth-shattering importance. The real things in the hospitals generally, certainly in Cherry Knoll, was the disputes of 73 and 74. 1973, when the ancillary staffs took industrial action, not strike action, industrial action, which meant restricting certain services in pursuit of their pay claim in, I believe, November, December 73. If I remember rightly, the crucial point then was not so much a matter of increase in wages as of maintaining their parity with the local government workers. I believe there had been some move whereby they would have been worse off in cash terms as opposed to their local government counterparts. And I think then, as I say, the main issue was to preserve their parity with the local government workers. This is rather strange in view of what's happened recently, when we've had the what has been called the dirty jobs dispute of this last winter, when the local government workers accepted their pay rise, and understand their pay rise always came before the ancillary staffs in hospitals. So this parity was maintained. But this winter, the local government workers accepted their pay rise, but one of the unions in the National Health Service, that is the National Union of Public Employees, held out against accepting the ancillary staff's pay offer, in spite of the fact that they had been offered the same as the local government workers, and in spite of the fact that the other three unions involved, that is the Confederation of Health Service Employees, the Municipal and General Workers Union, and the Transport and General Workers Union, had accepted. So what they were saying, in effect, was they wanted to get away from the parity which they had and to give the ancillary staff in hospitals more than the local government workers.
Mm.
If that was not the case, then of course it was just sheer bloody mindedness.
Mm. But in 73 you said that you were the first to come out, is that right, in the union?
No, this was in reference to the nursing pay dispute of 1974.
Oh, I see. So in 73 you followed the line...
In 73 this was a national pay dispute on behalf of the ancillary staffs.
Mm.
1974. Mind, one can say this. The nursing staffs at Cherry Knoll Hospital had a dispute in 1973 when they were unhappy about the promotional procedures at Cherry Knoll, mostly procedures relating to promotions from staff nurse to charge nurse ward sister.
Mm.
People became very frustrated when they found that there were people being overlooked who had been staff nurses with quite numbers of years' services. No adequate explanations given as to why they should not be promoted. One felt there was, in many instances, cases of nepotism occurring.
But with actual relatives being preferred, or just family?
One had this feeling as well, that relatives could be involved. Mm. This has also happened in later years, at a higher level, when there have been promotions to nursing officer. There was quite a case, a matter of 2 or 3 years ago, when unfortunately I was away on holiday and had to leave the matter in the hands of my branch chairman, who was a very capable chap, and he and a couple of other members, Alan Butler and Derek Dean, went in with Mr. Rainton. I'm saying 2 or 3 years ago, that's many more years since because if I remember rightly now, there was this meeting with the hospital management, and Mr. Jack Lyle was present. Now, Jack Lyle was chairman of the old hospital management committee, so obviously it must have been prior to 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because I remember Mr. Rayton was telling me just the other day that what happened, or at least telling me again what happened during that particular meeting, when the division nursing officer had been accused of nepotism by Mr. Rainton, and he asked Mr. Rainton what nepotism meant. And there had been quite a heated argument, and Mr. Lyle had told Swift to shut up and let Mr. Rainton have his say, and also Mr. Rainton to explain what nepotism meant, which he did in uncertain terms.
What particular incident brought it to a head, was it?
I think, really, I'd have to check my minute books about this, because at this distance in time, I'm not sure if it had anything to do with our walkout in 1973. Because we organised this walkout, which was done in a matter of, it was done in a matter of minutes. Mr. Swift, the division nursing officer, always maintained, of course it came as a tremendous shock to him, he always maintained that this was a very well, carefully thought out plan. In actual fact, it was not. It was done in a matter of minutes.
Mm.
Mr. Rainton came to see me with information about what was going on in the hospital.
Mr. Rainton was...
At the branch chairman.
Yes,
the way people were feeling about things.
About the promotion issue?
Yes.
What, somebody had been...
Someone had been promoted to the detriment of someone who we thought should have been promoted before. This is not to say the branch was trying to dictate who should be promoted, far from it. Mm. But anyway, I rang the BBC, and in a matter of minutes almost, those people were through and everything was organised. It looked more dramatic than it was. Even in 1974, when we had a concerted campaign of industrial action, there was nothing dramatic really happened. We caught the press headlines, the stories went round, but as far as hitting the comfort of the patient or the welfare of the patient was concerned, nothing happened.
So it was
as a matter of fact, at the end of the day, when the pay claim had been processed, which of course ended with the Horsbury report of that year, the management here sent for the branch representatives and congratulated us upon the manner in which the campaign had been conducted.
What action did you take here, Jim?
It amounted to, as I say, at that time, it was something new, and the same action wouldn't have the same impact today as what it had then. But it amounted more to not doing particular duties on the in the hospital, such as not acting up for people of a superior position, having these snap walkouts, meeting the outside, lasting for an hour or so, and then back to the wards. We also ensured that the wards were adequately covered for that particular period of time. Mm. One may say that if there were three on the ward and we left one, that it wasn't adequately covered. But at the same time, there was always sufficient people to ensure that nothing happened to the patients while we were off the ward.
So the thing was done for publicity, mate?
Publicity was the thing.
Yeah.
We realised that what was needed was public sympathy. Mm. And I think at the end of the day, even at the beginning of the day, we had the public support. It was just a matter of having this channelled into the right direction.
Did you do anything, harder, like banning admissions or something? Things like that, or ban having any emergency admissions, or
the branch itself did not take any direct steps to banning admissions. We took certain actions, which, in effect, forced the management to review their admission procedure, and initially it led to closing down of, for instance, the day hospital, some day unit, and this kind of thing.
Mm.
But the long stay patients themselves just were not touched. We've never said that we will ban admissions, because as far as we're concerned, admissions, I know some people in other unions have said, we will ban all but emergency admissions. Well, as far as we're concerned, who are we to class as an emergency admission?
Well, that's the next question. See? Have you been involved in that problem of that kind of? Where?
Not really. We take the view, we work in very close harmony with the consultants here, and they understood our position. They gave us our promise that they would not admit anyone who was not an emergency admission. In our limited capacity, we thought that what they did was right, and that people were not admitted who were not emergencies. But as soon as someone came along who they said was an emergency admission, we accepted. Because we realise, of course, the legal implications this could have for the consultants concerned.
So you'd be very reluctant to, in fact, challenge the notion of what an emergency.
Yes. That is not our.
Yeah. But because you accept that, in fact, it's the doctor's responsibility.
It's the doctor's responsibility. Yeah. Rightly or wrongly, the onus of admissions rests with the consultant.
But what if they were, say, to get over, as happened in some places, starting to admit people under sections that they wouldn't normally bring in under sections? Would that make you to?
That did not happen.
That didn't. But that would, did if it happen. Had, would it? Would you have changed your mind?
I don't think it would have happened, because, as I say, the consultants here have always been. We've always been on very good terms, and nowhere could I have seen that happen. No doubt it could possibly have happened in other hospitals where there may not have been the same report, but here that didn't. It just didn't arise. And I'm sure that the consultants kept their side of the bargain, and they did admit only emergency admissions.
What was the feeling of the nurses involved in the action? Were they quite prepared to take it, or did some members lost as a result? Well, Did you gain?
No, there were no members lost through the action itself. I think everyone realised that nursing salaries at that time dropped to so deplorable a level that something had to be done. Everyone, possibly the odd exceptions who were possibly too good for this world, wouldn't take any kind of action. Well, we took no action against them. We respected their feelings about the matter. Well, generally speaking, the nursing staffs, and let's face it, some of them would look upon this as being a bit of a lark, a bit of a giggle at times as well. But generally speaking, it was a serious do. And it was we had our own action committee. We met regularly to plan whatever action had been taken.
At this hospital control, level?
Yes, yeah. And to control what was being done. Yeah. So there was no danger of any people shooting off at a tangent and doing something which could have harmed the Confederation and could have harmed our case before the public.
Mm. There weren't any hotheads then who wanted to take it further?
Not in the Confederation.
No.
There were some hotheads in other unions. As a matter of fact, one of them finished up with an official reprimand for leaving. He happened to be on a ward.
Is this locally? Or?
Locally, and in Chernol.
Uh-huh.
This chap, this member of this other organisation,
Newpee,
who was on a ward, a one-man ward, and he left his post, which meant he left the ward with no nursing staff on, and he finished up with an official reprimand.
So Newpee do recruit amongst the nurses as well here, do they?
No. Oh yes, 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 great poachers.
What's the kind of state of play between the union and all that? Do you know? I mean, it's
an unfortunate thing that the hospital is now split into two between the Confederation and Newpee. Mm. There never was a Newpee branch here. The first Newpee member was a chap who started here as a nursing assistant some 14 years, roughly speaking. Mm. He was asked by the chief male nurse when he started if he intended to keep up his union activities, because apparently when he'd been working elsewhere, he had been quite active in the Newpee organisation. He said he was going to keep up these activities, but of course the chief male nurse had no option but to employ him, because he was deemed to be a suitable employee. Well, of course, once he came in, he started organising, first of all in the kitchens here, and he got a number of members in the kitchen. Eventually he left. Now, I couldn't say just exactly how long he'd been here altogether, but he'd built up a fair nucleus of members among the ancillary staffs by the time he left. They stayed in Newpee. Now, it wasn't until, I think, about the end of 1973, the beginning of 1974, that the Newpee organisation in this hospital took off. I went on holiday, fortnight's annual leave, and came back to find that these two former branch officers of COSY had left COSY, joined Newpee, and then went on a barnstorming tour of the hospital with all kinds of lies, innuendos, gossip, you name it.
Are these the two people that you referred to?
Yes. They went on this barnstorming tour of the hospital and gained quite a number of members that way.
They were nurses, were they?
They were both on the nursing establishment. One is, well, then he was a member of what was called the International, well, they call them Socialist Workers now.
The International Socialists?
International Socialists. They now call themselves the Socialist Workers. He was one. The other one is another charge nurse here, who's now their secretary, who joined, for reasons best known to himself, at a very intelligent guess, because he wanted to be top of the tree, and obviously he couldn't be while I was here.
Oh, you mean to run the union?
That's right. Yeah. If I had packed up as secretary of the union, he wouldn't have joined Newpee. He would have been secretary of the Confederation.
Yeah, these personal things often play a part, don't
that's,
they?
That's right. Well, I challenge them all to meet me in the hall to prove all the lies and things that they'd written, actually published. I still have settlers in my file somewhere, all the different things they sent out. I challenge them all to meet me in the hall. Bring along a who's that of mine, I'd meet them all. But there was never any takers. So now things are in a very most unfortunate position.
So the union, so the split between two unions?
Split between the two unions. And you see, there are two unions who can never operate together. I preached this at regional council level for the last few years. It's impossible to even talk to these people, let alone to work with them, because they'll twist everything you say and everything you do to their own advantage, which is for members and members.